Hey, glad you can make it. And welcome to the Employee Cycle Podcast, where we talk to HR innovators, thought leaders, and even some disruptors about the latest in HR trends, HR tech, and you guessed it, HR data. Well, you've heard enough of me talking. Now let's start the show. Before we begin, let's hear a quick message from our sponsor.
Hello, HR. It's me, your HR data. And I need to apologize. I'm sorry for being all over the place. I'm sorry for being difficult. I'm sorry for not being there for you. But it's not my fault. You put me in different HR systems and messy spreadsheets. But guess what? I now have a new friend, and their name is Employee Cycle. They can put all of me in one HR dashboard for you and keep me updated and simple so we'll better understand each other. Look, we're smarter when we're working together, so if you want me to show you my full potential, please go to employeecycle.com to get your free demo today. That's employeecycle.com. Promise me you'll go. Our relationship depends on it.
Welcome back to the Employee Cycle Podcast. I'm your host for today, Bruce Marable, CEO of the HR dashboard company Employee Cycle. And today we're going to be talking about what is an executive search firm and why you need one. Please help me welcome our very special guest, Matt Schwartz, founder of MJS Executive Search. Woo!
Thanks, Matt. Bruce. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thank you. All right. So before we actually go into the topic, can you do me and the listeners a favor and tell us how you ended up in the wonderful world of HR?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's very funny. In the world of executive search, most executive search professionals or recruiters would probably tell you they didn't wake up thinking they were going to be a recruiter or an executive search professional when they grew up, right? They kind of landed in it. For me, I came out of school and was in marketing and sales for a couple of years, and then found myself at a bit of a crossroads and started networking with some friends, and they had sent me to talk to a recruiter at a firm in New York City. After about, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes of sitting down and talking to this individual, he said, "Hey, did you ever think about doing this?" And this was retained executive search. And what they were interested in and what they liked about my background at the time was that I had both inside sales experience and had worked in the marketing services industry, which is actually the area that this company did a lot of work in. And I ended up joining that firm as a junior recruiter and spent 5.5 years there and really found my foundation to launch my career. So that was in the mid 90s. So it's been 25 years that I've been in executive search at this point. 5.5 years with that firm, got recruited to go to Heidrick & Struggles, one of the largest global search firms in the world. At one point, they were about a $500 million search firm known for placing more CEOs than any organization in the world. And then at the end of 2002, decided to break out and start MJS Executive Search.
Great. And can you give us a little bit about what does MJS do?
Yeah. So we are a retained search firm. Companies hire us on exclusive to be an extension of their organization to focus on some of the most unique, what we call transformational talent for their organizations. And the way we define transformational talent is roles that have often never existed before within our client's business, skill sets that are not organic to the company or the industry, or roles that need a significant upgrade due to an infusion of digital marketing or technology. So the nice thing about that is we are industry agnostic and not pigeonholed in one specific function. So over the last 15 years, clients have ranged from PepsiCo, American Express, Honeywell, DirecTV, Fidelity, New York Life, MasterCard, Henkel, Pitney Bowes, Equinox Fitness Clubs, just to name a few, and then a number of smaller, more entrepreneurial businesses, often private equity and venture backed. And today, the kinds of roles that we're involved in is are things like chief digital officers, heads of digital innovation, big data, artificial intelligence, machine learning, media, segmentation, user experience, usability research, cybersecurity. So all of the things that these companies are extremely challenged with, where there's a high demand and short supply.
Great. So we like to create frameworks on our podcast so that the listeners can understand exactly what are we talking about and how to make what we're discussing actionable. So you already went to this a little bit, but let's just define what a search firm does, and then let's go into the different types of searches that a company would hire a search firm to perform.
Fantastic. So in an ideal situation, a search firm is there to be an extension of a company's organization to identify the best talent possible to help them fill a very specific role. Within the world of recruiting, there's two types of search firms. There's contingent search firms, and then there's retained search firms. A contingent search firm is one that a company would give a job order to the contingency firm. They could give that same job order to multiple contingency firms, and they let them all fight it out in the market while still trying to find those people on their own, and whoever identifies the winning candidate will get a fee. Those types of firms, and there are a number of highly reputable ones out there, are very strong with somewhat commoditized roles, ones that they can build up a very specific functional expertise and bring them a number of people with those specific skills. On the other side, the downside about potentially working with some contingent firms is if you don't give that firm an exclusive, then and you're giving it out, giving the job order out to multiple firms, it could cause a free-for-all out in the market and search firms calling the same candidates and telling the job story and the company story a million different ways. So it's not that it's not they're not reputable or professional. It's just that, again, it can cause a little bit of a PR mess and a lot of confusion, as well as people fighting it out for the same individuals out there. On the other side of the table is retained search, which is what my firm does. We actually get hired on exclusive by our clients to be an extension of their organization to focus on very specific opportunities. Clients will often spend an hour to 4 hours with us, especially when it's a new relationship, to make sure that not only do we understand the role that we're looking to fill, but have deep insights into their company culture and vision moving forward. And for that, they pay us up front for our services. We typically get paid a third of the first year's total compensation by the client, and that fee is divided into three segments: a third up front, a third after 30 days, and then the last third upon 90 days or completion of the search. The reason why a company would do that is, one, they pay us for our insights. It's important that not only do we understand the job, but we can give them some perspective on the market in regard to what is realistic and what is not realistic, especially, and that could be everything from how much the candidates cost, their mix of skills. Are their expectations realistic, or can they only get a handful of skills, not the total package that they think they envision for the role? So, that's basically what we do, is we guide a client through a search and take the project from beginning to end.
Thanks for that. And I knew you just spoke about the different type of search firms, but what you explained, and I'm sure there are a lot of HR listeners out there that would agree, it almost sounds like a staffing firm. And maybe that makes you cringe sometimes when someone says, oh, you're just a staffing firm. So can you tell me and the listeners, what is the real difference between a search firm and a staffing firm?
Yeah, I would say volume. A staffing firm is typically there to provide many bodies for a variety of roles. And again, those might be more mid to low level manager type roles, where a retained search firm is typically reserved for very senior executive roles. So for example, a lot of your listeners and a lot of our clients, they probably have internal talent management, talent acquisition people on staff. Some of our biggest clients have upwards of 100 recruiters on their team who are immensely talented. But the challenge is they have so much volume on their desk, saving the company millions of dollars in fees for some of these lower level roles because they can do it on their own. The time that they need a retained search firm is when the volume of work that it's going to take and the expertise in a specific function to attract these people is beyond the bandwidth that they have. And so, there are cases in the area of artificial intelligence and machine learning. Those people are just so hard to identify, move from one company to the next, as well as if you're looking for the people with the most cutting edge skill sets, they're really few and far between. So a typical internal recruiter at a company doesn't have the bandwidth to reach out to 600 or 700 people to identify one candidate who's willing, who's qualified and interested for the role. So that's when they reach out to a firm like us to do that heavy lifting for them.
Interesting. So do companies typically exhaust all other options, all alternatives before they hire a search firm? Or have you found that a lot of companies realize and are aware enough that the roles that they're hiring for are so difficult and so unique that they come to a firm like you in the beginning?
That's a great question. Because of things like LinkedIn, for example, we all sort of have the same tools. The way we utilize those tools may be different. But we encourage our clients to put in as much effort as possible and exhaust their resources before they come to us. Sometimes they'll reach out to us or another search firm and say, okay, we've got two or three people in our pipeline, but we're not sure if any of these are going to be the right candidate. So we think we may need to go and do a search. So what we'll do is we'll encourage them to follow through with those candidates. At the same time, carve out those handful of names that if one of those gets the job, then our job is done and we are, no longer eligible to our full contracted fee.
Got it. And regarding the size of companies that typically hire search firms, is it more about how difficult it is to fill the role, or is it really about the size of a company? Because I'm assuming that it costs a little bit more than your regular staffing firm to hire a search firm, correct?
It does. But it doesn't. Again, some contingency firms can charge a significant premium depending on what kind of function they specialize in. When it comes to things like IT and financial functions, they may get as low as 15% of the first year's compensation as their fee, where ours is 30%. So, it's double what they charge. But again, we're talking apples to oranges here in terms of, the type of work and the level. They may do a lot more volume in terms of numbers of placements a year to make up the difference in the revenue levels of a firm like ours.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. But I guess one other thing that you were asking was about the size of the company. We often work with a lot of global Fortune 500 companies because they have the scale, the size, and the resources, and they're typically fairly sophisticated and understand when they should call in retained search and when they should try and do it on their own. We've done work with companies as small as $2 million in size, but that had strong financial backing from investors. But again, probably not the most financially prudent thing to do to, spend on a huge search fee when you're trying to build an entrepreneurial startup.
Got it. And from your experience, which roles, industries, or departments do you see hiring search firms the most?
Oh, anything in the C-suite. If there isn't a strong successor already highlighted within the organization, or a company's priorities or have shifted, sometimes they need expertise from the outside. So I would say a lot of the C-level roles within an organization. A lot of companies, if you think about this recent stat that I read, that since 2000, over 50% of the Fortune 500 have either been acquired, merged, or declared bankruptcy. You know, companies are going through dramatic change. And I would say the biggest change that we're seeing is that they're transitioning from being highly product-centric organizations to being more customer-centric. And the way to do that is to utilize all of the data that they have from different sources and leverage that to create a very focused, personalized experience on behalf of their customers. So that's triggering the need for everything from chief digital officers, big data, artificial intelligence folks, people in the new area, in media. So understanding how media is bought, sold, and distributed today, and then just general innovation. So those are some key areas that we're seeing the most growth in. But I'm sure there's many others out there in areas that we're just not focused on.
You just mentioned that a company would really want to work with you if there was no successor for that position to be filled. So my question to you is, when you are working with an organization, and I think you said that they always pay up front, but what if they do find someone internally? Do you still help them identify that person or interview that person to make sure that that's the right fit because you helped them with the initial search? Do you give back some of the money because they found their own person? And I'm asking because my wife is a real estate agent, and I'm just thinking about situations where she helps someone list their home, and then there have been examples where that person will say, oh, well, I found my own buyer, and we'll want a discount or something like that. So I'm curious as to how that works in your world.
Yeah, well, you've got a couple of different scenarios there. Very often, if there is an internal candidate, the client will let us know if they want us to compare and contrast that candidate against the outside candidates that we've identified. So sometimes we will do that. And again, they paid us to do a search. And often in the contract, whether it's our contract or their contract, they understand that they've hired us to do a search, an inclusive search, and really identify a wide range of people in the market. And so it'll say, you know, we'll get paid whether the person is identified by us or by them. Again, typically their efforts stop internally when they hire us, just because they've got plenty of other things to do. But at the same time, sometimes, you know, through our efforts, just, you know, from promoting the role and talking to lots of people and networking, someone will say, wow, I don't know where I heard about this job, but this recruiter called me. It's a great job for you. You may want to apply directly. And in that case, if a client's retained us on a role, they'll actually just forward the resume to us and say, hey, put this person, if they're qualified, put them through the same paces as you are, you know, your other candidates. And so, you know, it's a team effort, and we're helping them save a lot of time and a lot of energy by only bringing them the qualified and interested candidates for the role.
So we like to be actionable for our listeners. So let's put myself in the shoes of an HR leader who has a difficult position to fill. So let's go through this entire process of how do I work with a search firm. Do you ever reach out to companies and try to ask and gauge whether they have difficult positions to fill? Or is that on me internally to say, hey, team, we know that based off of market standards and everything that's going on with the crunch around talent, whether it's in tech or cybersecurity or whatever it is, this position is very difficult to find. We need to hire a firm. Or are there situations where you might even contact me, and how does that typically work?
Yeah, we get most of our business through referral. And then once we do a great job with that client, we like to say good work gets good work. So we end up getting more work. So we do a lot less of the cold calling, very active in things like social media. So you mentioned, what was the function? You mentioned a function recent just now. You know, we may, if we see, what was that? Sorry.
Cybersecurity.
Yeah. So if we see an area that we know that there's an extreme need for, we may write a blog post about it and promote that on places like LinkedIn directly out to, you know, this kind of talent management, talent acquisition, HR audience, so they can be aware of us. And if they do have a search, then, you know, they know who to potentially call. But, you know, I guess the next part of your question was, how do they go about deciding, one, do they need a search firm, and two, who should they choose? And in most cases, our client will, say, you know what, we probably need to hire a search firm because we see how difficult this is going to be, and we maybe don't have the expertise internally in that function to be successful. So we need to hire a search firm that does have that. Second, most of our clients bring in 2 to 3 search firms to talk to the hiring leaders to figure out which ones they should choose. So in the search business, we often call it a shootout. And basically what they're looking for are those industry insights that we spoke about, a strategy on how they would go about doing the search, a timeline of how long the search firm thinks it's going to take. And then, you know, by the questions and the interaction that the search firm has, typically they get a comfort level to say, these folks really understand this function in our company, and this is the group that I feel most comfortable with hiring to represent us on this role. So that's typically the thought process. Once they decide which search firm they're going to be using, then the process begins. And what that process means is, one, there needs to be an outstanding job spec developed. So the way we typically do that is we sit down for that, you know, discovery session to really either, you know, understand both the company and the job or just the position specifically. So we want to have enough information to build out a proper job description. So it's got the information on the company, the position, the qualifications, the responsibilities, and then, you know, how to contact us if someone is interested in the role. And again, we're not posting these roles. We're actually going out and identifying potentially qualified and interested people that we can tell the position story and employment story. From there, once the job description is developed, we develop what we call an acid test, which are the 3 to 6 key criteria that a candidate must have to be appropriate for the role. And we're going to use that acid test criteria to do phone screens, to conduct lengthy competency-based interviews. And it allows us to really be very clear with the client if someone is truly qualified, not qualified, if someone is in a 5 out of 5 in every category. Which are the points of the acid test are the most important, and how do they rank in those areas? And then if they're lighter in a specific area, is that something that they can grow in, or are there people within the organization that can support them and their area of deficiency? But beyond that core skill set acid test, we also look at cultural fit as well. So we want to understand a handful of criteria that's going to make someone a good corporate citizen within that organization and make sure that they're a true fit for that company, so there's no organ rejection. Once we identify those things, we literally go out to the market. We make sure we identify at least 90 to 100 candidates or prospects before we even start a search. And then from there, that list typically grows to 200 to 300 names before our job is done. And, you know, that obviously consists of lots of phone screens, many interviews, and then candidate presentations of only the top people who are truly qualified and interested in the role.
Nice, and thanks for that. So on average, what's the response rate of a candidate that you reach out to?
So people are overwhelmed these days. We have a very specific methodology in terms of our LinkedIn reach out. We definitely use LinkedIn as a jumping off point. It's not our only source, and but a lot of recruiters, I think, you know, will use it because you can get back so many high quality names and they'll just blast the universe. We will do a very targeted search, generate a long list of names, narrow down that list based on really looking at each profile one by one and be selective on who we send messages to. Out of those messages that they call in-mails that we send out to the market, we actually get an above average response rate of about 36% of the people that we reach out to will at least send us a message back. Doesn't mean they're interested in the role, means they're willing to have a conversation. For the remaining 64%, the my team will actually pick up the phone and try and get those people on the phone so they can talk to them one-on-one if, you know, they're unresponsive based on the initial in-mails.
Interesting. And on average, what does the time to fill typically look like? And I know that can vary based off of industry, level of role, geography even. But you know what? Let's go into that. Let's talk about some of the variables that can cause a shorter or longer time to fill and then what that typically looks like.
Yeah. So I would say on average today, it's somewhere in the 90 to 120 day range. I mean, we've filled searches as quickly as 2 weeks, but you know, based on the seniority of candidates, candidate and client travel, you know, sometimes it limits how quickly they can move, especially when they're trying to put interview slates together with senior people within an organization. So it becomes challenging. Sometimes we can develop the right candidate very, very quickly, but it takes months and months and months to move them through a corporate process. So that's the first thing. But the second thing that you mentioned is, you know, in terms of the challenge, is that so many organizations are allowing candidates to have a lot more flexibility today to do, you know, work remotely. Or if there's a lot of competition within that local market. So for example, in the world of artificial intelligence and machine learning, as you can imagine, Silicon Valley as well as Seattle, the Pacific Northwest, has a very large percentage of the talent or the best talent in that area. So people working for Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon. Well, if someone's working at Amazon, they know at any given time they could move across the street to any one of those other companies I just mentioned for a 20% raise plus significant stock options that will give them golden handcuffs for the next 2 to 3 years. So if they could find another great opportunity in their local market, it really changes the game and their willingness to want to move potentially across the country to, say, a role in the Northeast.
Let's talk about technology, because you did mention a lot of technical roles and a lot of companies in the tech space. So I know that there are a lot of video interviews and video interviewing technology that's being adopted specifically in the tech space. Is that happening a lot at the level where you're filling positions, or are those levels typically in that level of seniority typically too high of a role to do video interviews? Or maybe you're doing them just in the beginning. And two, when it comes to exposing and making the pipeline more transparent, are you sharing an applicant tracking system or you're using theirs? How are you actually sharing resumes or LinkedIn profiles?
Bruce, are you spying on us? These are all things that we do. So being in search for 25 years, I mean, I've seen it all. I've obviously done it when there was no video. I did it when video was very, very expensive. And when I was at Heidrick, I mean, it was not unlikely for a partner to be introduced to a candidate in the morning and fly out to see them for a meeting the following day. It was incredible. So people spent a lot of time, a lot more time on airplanes. Videos were again, super expensive. And now we've got better video quality and opportunity right at our desktop. So we use Zoom for our videos. Clients are very upfront that they don't want to foot the expense of flying me all over the country. So they much rather us video and just, you know, make sure we're super thorough. I would say the most challenging candidates to video are salespeople or sales leaders, just because they sell for a living. So you have to dig really, really deep to make sure that they're truly the real deal. Sometimes you lose some of the personal touch and sense of people's body language and things through video. But again, video has gotten a lot better and a lot easier to use, and it's super inexpensive now compared to what it used to be with going to a video center, a FedEx, Kinko's, etc. So that's one thing. The second thing is all of our clients want timely reporting. So we have weekly conference calls to go over our status and go over any new candidates that we have that we're presenting or are in the pipeline. So the way we do that is we use a ATS called Clockwork, which is really fantastic because it solved one of our biggest problems, which was client reporting. So what Clockwork does is it's actually a portal. It allows us to upload our logo, the client's logo, so their view is highly personalized. We build the search on the system and then can literally either give them online access that they can go in at any time, view a candidate's resume, LinkedIn profile. It pulls in a picture from LinkedIn as well. If it's legal in that area, we can put compensation information as well as build our overview and assessment of that candidate right there within that report. So we'll use those reports online to present all the way up to the board level of some organizations. The other nice thing is this report, a lot of our clients are often on the run, on the go, and they don't have the ability to log in somewhere. So we can download it to a PDF and send it to them that way as well. So the last thing that we like about Clockwork is that even though we may reach out to a couple hundred candidates for a opportunity, the client doesn't want to see that. They want to understand what our track is and how many, what our audience looks like. So we'll give them those stats, but we only highlight the handful of candidates that are either current active candidates that are in process, candidates that we've interviewed and rejected, or, you know, potentially have not made it through the client's interview screen. So it's a very focused, clear, helpful report that also saves us a lot of time and energy from, the hand typed reports in Microsoft Word tables that we used to do 15, 20 years ago.
As a founder of an HR metrics dashboard myself, I'm all about the HR data and metrics. So I'm curious about metrics on two different angles. One, what are those metrics that companies are looking at in those reports that you were just discussing? And then two, what are the overall KPIs that a company would measure your success? Is that time to fill? Is it coming in lower than what the approved budget was for the candidate? What are all those things? So first question, what are the metrics that they're looking at in the reports that you're giving to them weekly, monthly, et cetera? And then two, what are the overall KPIs for a company to measure a successful relationship with an executive search firm?
Yeah. Time to fill is definitely important. They're always very, very sensitive on time. They always have specific expectations on when they'd like to have someone on board. So, and the longer a search could potentially go, the more stressed and under pressure everybody is under. So we get that. So that's definitely something that everybody is cognizant of and moving things along. Two, if a search is not going the way a client would like it to, it usually comes down to a couple different things. One, either the company or the search firm have not reached out to enough people, so their sample or their audience is not large enough. Two, perhaps the expectations that they put out are unrealistic. So how do you adjust the expectations to make sure that they can be successful? And then three, I would say most of our clients really push us and look for diversity metrics. They're looking for a true inclusive slate of candidates that includes people of color, women, and others. And so, you know, we do our best to make sure every one of our slates is inclusive and not exclusive in any way.
So that's interesting. My next question was actually about diversity. So I'm going to flip this question on its head. You said that there are a lot of companies that are demanding a diverse candidate pool, but have you been surprised by a core group of prospects or clients that don't really care about diversity?
Honestly, for the last 10 years, it's been so important to every one of our clients that it kind of goes without saying in some cases. If it's a new client relationship to us, they will make sure that we're aware of that. But the good news is our diversity metrics are through the roof, especially in a lot of these technology areas where a lot of the people have been were born in other countries and then came here for PhDs and most of their work experience is in this country. So it's really helped them. But more importantly, the reason why our clients are pushing us for this is it's just great business. You know, you need to have an employee pool that represents your customer base, represents the world, and brings different perspectives to the table that aren't all the same. So they realize that it's has a huge impact on their top line and bottom line. And it's just, again, the right thing to do in business.
I watched a brief clip of you speaking when you were at the Inbound Marketing Summit, and you mentioned that companies are looking for people who have grown up in the digital space. So what did you mean by that?
So if we think back how long the internet has really been active, call it, 20 years, maybe a little bit longer at this point. Now, there are a lot of people that could say they've really grown up as true digital natives. So me in my, in my 40s, I have a really strong understanding of digital and what's happening, but that doesn't mean I live my life digitally day in and day out. And so it's amazing the perspective that someone can bring to the table if they've truly grown up in this internet age and lived their life in a truly digital fashion. So it's a huge benefit, now that companies are embracing more chief digital officers, the perspective that those people have is very different than the early digital leaders even 10 years ago.
Got it. And then lastly, for this section of the interview, let's talk about expectations. So what kind of expectations do you typically set for a client when you first start working with them?
When you say expectations, I mean, yeah, of course we set expectations. It's expectations of how long is it going to take to fill the role? What are the realities of people in that skill set? So we'll often have an understanding of the role prior to going in, bring some sample profiles to discuss with the clients to find out what they like, what they don't like, but also give our perspective. And then from there, also expectations around compensation. Sometimes clients have a very unrealistic view of what it's going to take to get that candidate and in that function. And sometimes they just, their budget doesn't allow it, or they need to realize that in order to compete against some of the most successful companies in the world, they're going to have to really adjust how they pay people to attract these folks.
And I'm sure with your company being super awesome and always doing a great job, that you've had to come after another firm who did not fill a position. So what does that look like when you're setting those expectations? We are already coming in knowing that this company has been let down, they're frustrated, and now they might have to put even higher, a higher level of pressure on you to get it done.
Yeah, that actually just happened to us recently, and it was unfortunate, but you know, we just hadn't, the company did not know us up to that point. And so they hired us for one market in the Midwest, and they felt we did such a great job. They said, wow, you know, our other search firm failed miserably for a Mid-Atlantic role that was the same as the Midwestern role, and said, hey, can, you know, I know, it, you know, we just spent a lot of money, but, you know, you guys brought us more qualified and interesting candidates within 3 weeks than we saw in a year with the other firm. So basically we proved ourselves, and we were able to showcase that we really understood this kind of unique, innovative, entrepreneurial profile that the client was truly looking for versus someone who is a super traditional person out of their industry. So, you know, sometimes just telling them that you're good at what you do isn't good enough. You really have to show them. And so we tend to come to the table, whether it's with case studies, with sample profiles, you know, because they want to understand that we're going to be able to connect the dots and be reaching out to the right people and telling a compelling story on their behalf.
And before we go to our next section of the interview, are there any last words of wisdom that you would like to impart on our HR listeners about why they should hire an executive search firm, what types of positions that they should look to fill with an executive search firm, and just the best way to build a relationship and work together?
Yeah, I'm so surprised how many of our clients work with firms that they're really just not pleased with. And, you know, there is always going to be a firm that focuses on a specific function that is just awesome at what they do. So don't settle. Focus on talking to your peers and your colleagues to find out, you know, and explore and build relationships with firms that may be better than the ones that you're currently using. You know, it doesn't hurt to have a half hour phone conversation or a brief video just to make sure that you're feeling, you know, good about who you're working with, because a lot of times people have just accepted that, you know, most search firms are not very good at what they do, which is really disappointing for our industry. So I would say, you know, don't settle for anything but excellent work and the best quality candidates that your company can attract.
Thank you for that. That was pretty awesome. So now we're going to go into my favorite section of the interview where we get to know you a little bit better. And it's called The Real, The Random, and The Ridiculous, where I ask you a real, a random, and a ridiculous question. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. So the real question, for all of you who have heard this podcast 1, 2, or 10 times already, you know that my real question is always, do you like bread pudding? And if so, how do you like it made?
I do not like bread pudding.
Is that a you do not like it, or it's just not your favorite?
if it's on the menu or it's there, I do not partake. I'm kind of a bit of a health nut and exercise, you know, freak. So I'm pretty, although I do eat dessert, I'm not going to say I'm completely off sugar by any means, but it's very, I'm very, very selective in what I indulge in. So bread pudding is not my thing.
Okay. Well, I can't be mad at you for health reasons. you just didn't like it, then, you know, we would have an issue. But okay, that's fair. So the random question, what's the most random or unique position that your firm has ever had to place?
Ah, love that. All right, you buckled in? So
I'm ready.
All right,
I'm ready.
So PepsiCo was a client of ours for many years, and we had placed a number of very traditional marketing people, corporate communications folks, then they came to us and said, hey, you know, it's 2008. We need our first head of global social media, which we filled, which was very, very early in the world of social media. And then, shortly after that, we filled the head of global digital strategy and development. So, you know, these were all new roles to the organization, highly innovative. And they said, you know, you've already done these kind of unique roles that have never existed here before. You know, we have another role, or actually a couple roles that we're building a department around. And, you know, we don't think there's any firm that really has expertise in this area. So we want to give you a shot. So to give you some color on this is PepsiCo had just bought back their bottlers. And with that, they inherited vending, fountain, and cooler equipment. So Pepsi is in the market of manufacturing and marketing drinks and snacks, but they didn't own vending machines. You know, that was always done by the distributors themselves. So Pepsi in their marketing brilliance said, we're going to turn these vending machines into what we're calling retail-tainment. So they wanted to take a vending machine, turn it into a giant touchscreen like an iPad, give it facial recognition so it could understand who was standing in front of the machine and either provide an ad that would, you know, speak to that person or allow them to maybe play a video game or sing karaoke with Beyonce, have the machines connected allow people to pay with their phones, have the machines connected to the internet so they could collect data on every transaction for manufacturing, supply chain, maintenance. So they said to us, they said, hey, you know, we're looking for engineers with MBAs who have created products or services that have never existed before and have made a significant impact on the market. And we want these people to reinvent our vending, fountain, and cooler equipment. And so we went out and took on this search. And believe it or not, the first person we placed was one of the creators of Xbox Kinect at Microsoft.
Wow.
So that person was sitting in a technology company at Microsoft, not thinking that his next role was going to be at a package goods company. And, you know, he went and ended up spending about 6 or 7 years on that team, you know, building this equipment. The next one was one of the leaders of the Microsoft's Ford Sync relationship, where people started talking to their cars for the first time. So he came over to do all of the, you know, connected equipment. And then one of the other people we placed actually worked for an industrial shipping company that was building all sorts of connected pallets and sensors so companies could track their merchandise all over the world through RFID and other technologies. So, you know, very interesting, you know, that we could look at not a linear path for people to take these roles, but really, you know, we like to say we invent people. We have to take a mix of skills from a variety of roles, combine them, be able to tell the conceptual story, and you know, get them on board to be successful.
Wow, that was pretty awesome. That was a great answer. And then the last question, the ridiculous one: what's the most ridiculous reason you've ever been told why a company didn't want to work with an executive search firm?
I don't know if I have an answer for that. They're usually pretty standard, and I would say the biggest objection to working with a firm is just pure cost. It can feel very expensive, but based on time and hopefully the return based on the work that this placement or this successful candidate provides for the company, it should pay for itself, you know, over and over and over again. But you know, I don't think there's any major reason why, you know, a company wouldn't work with a search firm. I mean, they typically tend to be, you know, fairly sophisticated. They've experienced both and have a reason why they choose, you know, retained search versus a contingent search versus an internal search.
And then final question of the interview, what's your least favorite and favorite part of HR or executive search?
We have a saying in this business that it's the highest highs and the lowest lows. The excitement and elation around finding a great candidate, evaluating that candidate, and then placing a specific candidate is fantastic. But the challenge is you're dealing with people's lives, you're dealing with people's livelihood, you're dealing with what could be an immense amount of change in this person's life if there's a relocation involved. You're also dealing with a lot of potential uncertainty. You know, we like to say, you know, the devil they know is sometimes better than the devil they don't. So, you know, going through those emotions and having empathy with the candidate and helping to bring these two parties together between the company and the client can be very, very challenging. So again, you know, when there's heartbreak and something changes and someone does not, you know, work out or take a job, you know, it can be very, it can really let you down. But at the same time, you know, we've improved people's lives and companies for the better based on the success of the individuals, you know, taking these roles.
Matt, thanks so much for being on the podcast. We really appreciate you and your time. Thanks for dropping so much wisdom and knowledge on our listeners. We really appreciate you.
Woo! Thank you, Bruce. Matt.
So where can people find you and MJS online?
Yeah, absolutely. So our website is mjsearch.com. I've also got a free gift to your listeners. We have an ebook around transformational talent that your listeners may enjoy. And the way to get that is they can text MJSearch to 44222. Again, that's MJSearch to 44222. They'll ask you for your email address and we'll shoot that ebook right over to you.
We would definitely put that in the show notes. So, Matt, thanks again. And for all you listeners out there who really appreciated this episode, please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes and leave a note. We love to make this podcast as great as possible, as educational as possible for you. So the more constructive criticism and feedback you give, we read it all. We love it. We appreciate it. And if you don't have us downloaded on your favorite podcast player yet, we don't know what you're waiting for, but it's time for you to do that. So, HR folks, please continue to hire, train, and retain the best workforce possible. Later, kids.